We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse.
Greetings and welcome back to another exciting installment of the Fifth Column Podcast. This is your weekly return of the soul to the new cycle of people that make it, and occasionally ourselves. I am Camille Foster. I'm someplace up the coast. I am also here with Matt Welch. I'm not here, but he's on the thing. So there's the internet transom, you know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
And Michael Moynihan, yes, who is also on the internet. And the three of us are together, but not quite together, which is a little sad, but also wonderful. And I am delighted to see you, gentlemen, via this internet connection. It's quite good. Long week. The hell is going on?
Well, you know, we've gotten used to seeing you in person because we've done a bunch. We did the Megyn Kelly shows in person. And by the way, I got to point something out about that.
Yeah.
We did learn on the way out of the last Megyn Kelly broadcast that she had been coming into the studio to film in person with us. And maybe it was Matt who said, yeah, like who's next or who's, and she said, I only do it for you guys.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very flattering. And I'm not sure if we talked about afterwards, the most interesting bit of that was that we were in the green room having a conversation with Fat Joe. Did we talk about this or not?
I don't think referenced it.
I don't know if we mentioned
it. Did we reference it?
Yeah. Maybe on a members only one, but.
I saw him twice in 2 days, by the way.
Oh.
Which is the weirdest thing because I saw him, obviously, at the Megyn Kelly thing. And then I went to the Knicks game and he was sitting up front with Tracy Morgan. And I was like, look, it's Fat Joe. This is my daughter. And I was like, that's Fat Joe. And she's like, who? I was like, I don't know. He's a rapper.
They have the exact same accent. They are the same person.
Fat Joe and Tracy Morgan?
Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah. I mean, like...
I mean, Tracy Morgan's is a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
The way to do, people point out often that I try to do accents and sometimes I fail. But you try to pay attention to them. The one thing, how to get the key to Tracy Morgan's accent is, and the person who does it in the most amazing impression is Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, of course.
Who worked with him on 30 Rock. But is that he says the word hilarious? He's like, that is hilarious, and that is like, that is the key to Tracy Morgan's voice, is hilarious. But I think we also once told the story of the interaction that he had with John McWhorter, which I was mentioning, when we all ran into him at the Comedy Cellar, and he knew who he was, which was completely baffling.
Yeah.
He walks by him, turns around, and says, "Yo, professor!" Yeah. And I was like, "Wait, what?"
He didn't just know who he was; he loved him.
Yeah. He loved him, and it was hilarious, but it was a very fun night. But,
I mean, anyway. Matt is correct.
I think we've told that story before.
No, Matt is correct that they're both from the Bronx, so I suppose they do have that in common, and it's possible that there are some patterns of speech that are similar as a result, but I think they sound decidedly different.
Okay.
But
yes.
there it is.
I did mention to you guys that a long time ago, and I have to check this with my friend Dave, who at the time pointed out to me, I think in like 93 or something, I think it was in the Source magazine, and it was either an ad, or I think it was an ad and had a picture of Fat Joe, and the text said, Fat Joe, and I'll never forget this, Fat Joe is one live Puerto Rican, but you think that he's black from the way that he's speaking. So I think that is real, and I'm not entirely sure. I have to fact check that, but I do remember it, so. I couldn't have made that up, right? It's too weird to have made it up.
The key is that he's doing heroic work about healthcare price transparency.
That's true. Yes.
And we're going to, you know, we're trying
he's meeting on good people in Congress.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty impressive.
Genuinely was. At some point in the conversation, I asked him, I was like, have you talked to anyone at like the Cato Institute? He's like, what is that?
Yeah, yeah. You looked at it, it's like, you do understand that I'm Fat Joe, right?
I mean, Fat Joe went on for like 10 minutes about
price
transparency in healthcare.
Yes.
And I mean, did you know there are no prices? You have four different people.
And I was like, I know,
same
dude,
hospital,
this is...
same doctor, same procedure, different prices. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm like, what's up, libertarian? I mean, he was going, I was like, yes, exactly. There's no price there's price sensitivity when you actually pay it yourself.
Yeah.
And it was funny, we're having this conversation with him. And then at one point, I said to him, I was like, Fat Joe isn't very fat anymore.
Yeah.
And I think he said he was taking, that he had taken Ozempic.
Ozempic, yeah. He's Ozempic Joe.
And I said, and I remember saying to him that I thought Ozempic Joe was not a very good hip hop. Because he's definitely not, he's thin Joe now.
Yeah.
So. But
yeah,
you
yeah.
guys are both like sharing your diabetes tips.
Yeah, and, he's a type two.
Yeah.
And he's like manager of the guys in his crew. Because, you know, as people who have ever been around somebody in the hip hop universe knows, that if you're and even remotely successful in the hip hop world, you travel with no less than 48 people. So there's one guy who was really nice dude, and he was like, you know, you take Humalog, and I was like, what? Jess, how do you? And he's like, oh, my girlfriend was type one, and we had a great diabetes conversation.
Yeah,
it was, but Fat Joe obviously is he had fat people diabetes, he had type two diabetes.
help my memory here. And, you know, I don't feel like I'm talking too out of school or that Ozempic Joe would be mad if I mention this. But at some point he got up, right? Yeah. He was going to go do his thing. And one of his 48 guys in the green room to help him out.
I think he only had like four guys with him, to be fair.
I think there was
three. But like there's 45 right. off stage.
Yeah.
Helped him on with an extra hoodie. Like he was like, mm-hmm. he was just there immediately. But what was the garment that he helped him on with?
It was a jacket or a hoodie or something.
It was like but it was very James Brown like.
Yeah.
He got up and then someone came and just put, and that's the thing, like, you know, it's like the most useless thing to have, someone putting a jacket on for you, but it's very much a statement. It's like, I have a person who puts my clothes on for me. And it was pretty great.
So
he was a very, very nice guy.
Which of the
nice.
Two of you was like the most like taking notes and like, oh yeah, I can see the jacket helper wrong. I guess
it's Camille. Clearly Camille.
Yeah. That's Camille.
Yeah.
All
right. Go on. Go on.
Like, there is a point in before we get into the real issues of the day.
I think I'm the only one who like knew any of the songs that Fat Joe.
Of course.
No, Moynihan did too.
But no, I knew. But the thing, the funny thing is when he came in, and there's a point, you know, when you've been doing this for a long time and you kind of see these people around.
These people.
You know, famous
these
people.
Puerto Ricans.
Puerto Ricans is what I'm talking about. Yeah. You see Puerto Ricans around and you're like, oh, am I in Puerto Rico? No, but you see like famous people around and everything. And you know, first you're like, oh my God. And then you kind of get used to it. And it was so funny when he came in, there was no like, oh, how do we back into this conversation? You know, we should like say hi or anything. He walked in and Camille goes, Fat Joe! I was like, okay, I guess that's how we're gonna break the ice here. Yeah.
That's what I do when I see any large man. Just say fat something. Yeah. Just insert fat any random name.
Fill it in.
Yeah.
Fill it in.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of people who...
Fat Joe says the N-word, for the record.
Yeah. Well, speaking of people who
just
got
like Matt,
off.
Yeah.
Of murder charges because somebody said the N-word. Rest in power, King. O.J. Simpson.
Yeah. Wow.
Is dead.
Lost a real one.
Yeah. We lost a real one. And that is, it precipitated a lot of Norm MacDonald jokes that people were sending around. his time as the host of Weekend Update. And if you haven't seen, there's like an 11-minute supercut of his best. I'm not even his best, but some of his best OJ jokes. And there's the one, and I'll pop it in right here because it's the funniest joke of all time. And I don't even need to say anything. I'll just pop it in right here.
In his book, OJ Simpson says that he would have taken a bullet or stood in front of a train for Nicole. Man, I'm going to tell you, that is some bad luck when the one guy who would have died for you kills you. That's garbage. You don't get worse luck than that.
But there's a lot of funny.
I would remind ourselves and our cherished listeners that our very, very first episode, April 1st, 2016, we spent a good deal of time talking about, and I think yelling at each other, or yelling at me mostly, because I was like, yeah, he's definitely innocent.
I mean, legally, yes.
Yeah.
You said that Michael Tracy. From, he's innocent of plenty of things. He's innocent of plenty of things.
What was the tweet that you sent from Michael Tracy, I guess? What was that one? Do you have that in front of you?
It was even better than my hilariously...
Misguided defense of a double murderer.
My take on O.J. Simpson is that people who are acquitted of crimes after extensive, laborious trials should not be assumed to have committed crimes for which they were acquitted. What? I mean, it's an interesting.
I guess juries never get it wrong.
That's a fair, and so fair you can, standard. Yeah.
No, I mean, legally, sure. I mean, you can't just go around saying, he's a double murderer because legally he's not. But I can also have watched the same trial as the half-wits that were in the jury box who were really, really dumb and said that he was innocent. And then one of the guys who gave him a Black Power salute on the way out. Which I didn't realize at the time.
Neutral power salute.
Yeah.
Why do you gotta racialize it?
Well, I think that was the racialization. It wasn't like a salute like he was in the Navy or something. Yeah. It was a Black Power salute. Yeah.
But it's actually kind of an interesting distinction to make. Should not be assumed to have committed the crime. I think it's like, who is the we, or who is the person doing the assuming? We all, as individual human beings, have it completely within our purview to come to our own conclusions about shit. It doesn't mean that you write in a news article, murderer O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
You can't really do that. And that's been one of the fun to listen to and want, broadcast people try to come out with, O.J. Simpson, who was made famous for being in the center of a murder trial. They just keep trying to find ways to not do the Norm Macdonald, which is one of the reasons why the Norm Macdonald's so funny, because he just said it straight
every
up.
Single punchline was that he was a murderer. That was literally the joke every time, and including the one when he was acquitted and they showed the headline that weekend after. And he said, it's official. Murder is now legal in California.
Gosh.
which is a great. But by the way, one of those jokes that I watched in the Norm Macdonald compilation today reminded me that the racial makeup of the jury was 9 black people. 9.
Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive.
It has to be seen, and it usually is, in the context of the Rodney King trial and the riots.
Of course.
And the initial trial of the L.A. police who participated in the gang stomping.
Stacey Coon. Yes.
Of Rodney King.
Whose last name was a racist insult.
Okay.
I just realized right now. Lord.
Okay.
It's a different word, but sure.
Different. I mean, when you're thinking of it in those terms, you're like, well, wait a second. That's pretty offensive.
That was either an all or a mostly white jury there, unlike.
Because it was in Simi Valley, right?
In Simi Valley, which is where the cops live instead of having to live in the places that they do their policing. And that was a dynamic that was much more at play in 1990s LA than it is in current LA. And so I think one of the ways to think about the OJ trial and verdict is. Because of Rodney King, a pendulum started swinging in the other direction, and he was sort of the first person, maybe the pinnacle person to take advantage of that swinging the other way. Was not a deal breaker in Southern California to have a racist cop testify against you at a trial. It just was not. We had racist cops all over the place in Southern California in the 1980s and 1990s. And Camille, don't even need to shake your head at me about this.
What did I say?
It wasn't, just preemptively. That was a preemptive strike. and it wasn't that big of a deal. Daryl Gates was not the greatest person in the world. And he was
Matt Welch, 2024.
But that became an issue afterwards. So did the composition of juries, the racial composition of juries, and it swung in the other direction. In the other direction, and then suddenly it leads to this point where someone who has a ton of money can throw the best lawyers the money can buy at it and play in all of these things and take advantage of those dynamics and the perception of them changing and to get off of after absolutely committing a double murder of horrendous thing. And there's I forwarded you guys this thing, and I hesitate to say this out loud because my haters will jump up and down on it. But Ann Coulter wrote a column today, and she made the argument, which I don't agree with, but it's interesting to think about, that the OJ trial, the OJ verdict, was the end of a certain type of racial politics at that time. She says that it's like Al Sharpton. She draws a direct line between the verdict and just the insanity around it. And the monomaniacal attention that the entire country, and not just the entire country, the entire world, every single day, lead story in Hungary, where I lived at the time, in Budapest, on every paper and in every nightly news was the OJ trial. Like it was everywhere all the time in a language and a culture that didn't understand any of it. But that she said that directly led to, for example, people who were falsely accused by Tawana Brawley finally getting sort of their justice back. It trimmed the sales of Al Sharpton.
Stephen Pagonis,
thank you for remembering the name. It trimmed the sales of Jesse Jackson in that kind of like that model of civil rights direct action foundations, nonprofits, organizations, or whatever, who would come to you and say, look, you know, if you don't want to be called racist, you need to do this, why, that, and the other. That stopped working in her telling. I don't know if that's true. I don't think that it is.
It's also keep in mind that because you forwarded that piece to us, is that that was an excerpt from a book that she wrote in 2012.
So interesting.
I'm wondering how that she would view that today. And that was from some book that she wrote about race. I'm sure it's just a totally normal book. It's funny about the jury composition. I just looked this up because I needed to remind myself of some of the headlines in 2017, 2018 about when Trump attacked what he called the Mexican judge. Yeah. He was Mexican-American. And all the headlines, there was one from CNN, like revisiting, it's still jarring to revisit the time when Donald Trump attacked the Mexican-American judge and said he couldn't be fair and unbiased. And it's like, well, that's a silly thing to say, particularly because he's a judge. And that's literally his job.
And also not from Mexico.
And it's but at the same time is that it is also just him doing exactly what you do when you do jury selection for the O.J. Simpson trial. You expect that you're probably going to have a better shot with African-American jurors if you're Johnny Cochran during jury selection. And that's just presuming that somebody, because of their background, is more likely to have a particular point of view. I mean, that's every jury selection, right? And that's every time we talk about, you know, voting patterns, et cetera, that there's some truth to it. And in the OJ case, it turned out to actually be a very good strategy. And it's funny because what Trump did is that in the way that only a dummy like Trump can do it, was he was essentially making that same point that everybody makes about jury selection, right? But he was doing it to a judge, which is, again, slightly different. But that, I think, is where that instinct came from, was that common thing that you say, like, well, if it is this trial, we want to make sure that if we can load the jury with people who are African-American and then do things like the most amazing thing that they did, which was when they went for the jury walkthrough of the Rockingham House, they took all the pictures of white people down and replaced them with like pictures of like James Baldwin.
OJ became black in that. So Camille, I mean, like given the way Michael has set that, and that kind of the mirror image that doesn't really acknowledge how they're the Spider-Man meme when it comes to race. And given your own, you know, pretty extreme sense of race abolitionism, or at least that like race is the way that we consider race is warping to degrees that we just are not in daily contact with reality. I'm just kind of curious what it's like to you to reflect on the legacy of OJ and like the trial and the stuff that comes after.
I mean, I was, what year was this that the trial was? It was 14, 15?
Yeah,
14. So I was about 13, 14 years old. I remember watching the verdict come in school. And I remember—
Did you cheer?
Of course I did. Yeah. of course. Yeah. There were people running through the halls. There were cartwheels. It was a celebratory affair.
It's like an audience cutaway in Death Comedy Jam or something. Like yes. People like rolling in the aisles.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's Cat Williams up on stage.
So, you know, at the time, I mean, it was clear, you know, our guy won. Mm-hmm. And that was all there was to be said about it. And today, I think I stand with Mark Lamont Hill, who I will quote, says, O.J. Simpson was an abusive liar who abandoned his community long before he killed two people in cold blood. is acquittal for murder.
I think there's some kind of comparison. Long before he killed people, he abandoned his community. I mean, look, this is a bad guy.
It's almost the same. His acquittal for murder was the correct and necessary result of a racist criminal legal system, but he's still a monster, not a martyr.
Okay.
I don't even know what that means.
Well, what it means is,
but I do know it has 6,400 likes.
Yeah. What there was that People versus OJ Simpson documentary, which was like a 6-parter or 5-parter, some very long one. I think it was a 30 for 30. At least it was played on 30 for 30 by ESPN. And it's good in parts, but it is bookended by these episodes about him like abandoning black people. And of course, the famous quote from OJ Simpson, I'm not black.
I'm OJ.
Which is great, which is like the best thing he ever said. Yeah. He ruined it by cutting somebody's head off, which is usually kind of like, I don't know. It's like you're not going to get into Bartlett's after murdering.
Are you saying that's
people.
A black thing?
I think that like when he said that and you see him and it's like we talked about this, I think, on the show way back when, because I remember watching it and being annoyed by it. And particularly when you realize that everyone is racializing something. That for OJ, the only person ever racialized that was OJ after he was arrested and then made himself into a black figure and realized that that was the best way to play this and get off, and which helped him get off, of course. But but in this stupid documentary on these people, he abandoned his community. No, what you can say if you're Mark Lamont Hill and be like the quasi-Marxist and say, you know, there's wealth disparities, et cetera. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Way you solve that, why that is, we differ on, but that it's true, right? And what OJ did was he became famous and he started hanging out with rich people. A lot of those rich people were white. He also hung out with rich black people too, by the way, and it's not as focused on because it blows up the narrative a little bit. But OJ Simpson hung out with rich people, and that he abandoned his community. It's like, what was he supposed to do once he was like a, you know, multi-millionaire, you know, dodging people pulling their luggage through O'Hare Airport, you know, jumping over them for Hertz. I mean, this is kind of a crazy thing to say that he was abandoning his race. What is your obligation to a race when you become famous? I mean, he was friends with Al Cowlings. He was friends with all these football guys. Marcus Allen, who was fucking so his wife. I guess they were not friends. But I just don't understand that. Like, he was hanging out in Hollywood. He became an actor. He became a pitch man. He became a sideline reporter for NBC, which is where I saw him when I was a kid.
He was in the booth, too. Yeah,
he was in the booth,
ABC.
Too.
ABC. He was in the gold jacket.
Because I remember him at NBC because I was, I have a photograph of him. And my dad, when I was a kid, my dad worked for the Patriots. And I saw OJ and I have a picture of him that I took when I was like 10 or something on the sideline. Before he was like in his murdering phase.
Are you next to him giving the thumbs up saying, or doing like that neck?
Like, yeah, I was just like, I was looking at every blonde woman and I was like, run, just get out of here. So, cause he's going to get angry at some point. That kind of thing from Mark Lamont Hill is this idea of like, OJ is a racial figure or is that kind of traitor is insane to me.
He just said community, so I think maybe he means that the hardworking Buffalo fans.
No, or famous rich athletes. Maybe that's what he means. Famous rich athletes who commit murder, which, I mean, you know, there's a gang of those people. They don't all get off.
And by the way, the people he was hanging out with when he was arrested for stealing his own stuff in Las Vegas, where he actually went to prison.
Yeah.
I think those were all white people too. So even after he was let off, he was like, I'm just sticking with the whites at this point. I don't know why. But the crazy thing about that is I actually thought that was deeply unfair what happened to him.
Oh, that particular trial?
Yeah, not because...
So double jeopardy. Come on.
It was double jeopardy. I mean, like literally, he clearly went to prison because it was like, we didn't get you the first time. And he went to prison for a long time. Do we have a guy like that guy on Rogan, Jamie, who can check this up? How long can we ask ChatGPT? How long did he go to jail for the stealing of his own material?
It looks like 9 years, but I don't know if that's true. I haven't fact checked that.
I think that sounds about right. I mean, he was in prison for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's like, look, he got off and he shouldn't have gotten off.
Mm-hmm.
And also that Michael Tracy thing is like this. I mean, the racist criminal. It's like there was one person in that trial who was clearly a racist, or had said racist things. I don't know. I don't know much about Mark Furman beyond, you know, the tapes he made when he was trying to be a Hollywood writer or something. Do you remember that? That was the deal. He was talking to a Hollywood writer and he was trying to like present himself as, but there was other evidence that he was a pretty, pretty bad dude.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that doesn't, I mean, it doesn't mean that the justice system is racist. It means that somebody who was in the police department was racist. And that's,
it wasn't just that he was racist. I think that it, I mean, that was the main thing, but also that he planted evidence.
Right. and bragged about it. Yeah.
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 This is a bit of a thing. And like, I mean, I said, I'm pretty sure on the very first episode of this podcast that my Law and Order dad, who by the way, is at a stage of his like late in life, just had, you know, replacement hip surgery because he fell down, dementia at age 85. And I'm not talking out of school when I mention all this stuff. This is not for sympathy. This is for like celebration, where like the facts and the fiction are just rolling together beautifully.
Yes. And now really he thinks he's Al Cowlings.
He thinks that my sister is.
You know who this is, damn it. This is Matt's father.
He thinks that my sister, in addition to being his daughter, is also Frank Sinatra's daughter, which is just awesome. Like,
oh, wow, like, that's great.
Who doesn't want the upgrade? He offered my my daughter.
Ronan Farrow doesn't want the upgrade.
I mean, that's the accurate answer. He offered my my sister-in-law. It's like, hey, you know, after she was doing something nice, he's like, hey, I'll build a rocket for you and send you to the moon.
Nice.
Wow, it's like an episode of The Honeymooners. That's great. Yeah, to the moon.
He has been taking credit recently for being the person who brought both the Dodgers and, in a geographical curiosity, the Angels from New York to L.A. Like, he's just, he's in a great place.
I mean, I tell you what, I have some people in my life who have dementia and people who, you know, not my, my father passed away. It's not my mother. She's sharp as a tack. But other people, and there's a fear amongst the people who they're related to that that will trickle down and like, oh my God, is it like genetically encoded that I'm going to have dementia too? And my argument has always been that I kind of hope that I get dementia because it's like those are tough years. And if you think you're Branch Rickey, then fucking great. I mean, that sounds amazing to me.
The bad part about it is that you're confused about what just happened and you don't know who's around you and all that's a nightmare. But like, my dad is a really sweet guy.
Yeah.
And he's always was telling like tall tales and shaggy dog stories, and they have just become the overall beautiful reality. I love it. But I brought him up not just to celebrate my dad, who I'll hopefully see soon, but his reaction to the OJ trial, and he is a Law and Order Republican, always was. Who knows what he is now when it comes to that. But he said that it was correctly decided in his view. Not that OJ didn't do it, but just that the pervasive shitty behavior on the part of cops in LA. And it's just like something that he knew.
But as a juror, and I remember there was a moment that when that miniseries came out, which is great, by the way, the one that has David Schwimmer as Robert Cardi going juice. There's a great compilation of it. Have you seen this? It's like 90-second compilation of him saying juice.
It's so good.
It's great. But in watching that, there's two things that I watched that and then I said, oh, that's based on The Run of His Life. Was that the name of the Jeffrey Toobin book? I'm no great fan of Jeffrey Toobin, as I think people probably know. But that book is very good. It's like, because he was sent there to report on that by Tina Brown when Tina Brown was the editor of The New Yorker. And the stuff is terrific. I mean, it's just, he paints a pretty vivid picture, and he's a good kind of magazine writer. And that as a book, there were a couple of moments in that book where I was like, oh my God, it's so clear that he did it. I mean, I always kind of knew that, but there was a, and I have to go back to the book and remember what it was. It was something about the Bronco, about it being at his house and it being locked and there being blood inside, et cetera. There was something that was like pretty clear that no matter how many racist cops were there, I remember all these names of Detective Van Adder and all these people that it's incredible that it sticks in the memory. And the other thing that I remember about that book is how unbelievably, and he doesn't focus on this. This is just something I took away from it. How unbelievably shitty everyone treated Marcia Clark, who was, is skilled, had the deck stacked against her. She had the, on the other side of that aisle, the most well-compensated defense team in probably the history of America, if not the history of the
Bailey.
World. I mean,
come on.
The hideous monster of F. Lee Bailey, you know, Barry Scheck, Robert Kardashian, who was like, he was literally on the bench. He was like, of those guys, the worst of them. Johnny Cochran, who was an amazing talent for being a complete scumbag. And, he's just a horrible person, but he was good at being a horrible person. But, you know, I mean, Darden, I was never that impressed with, but I think Marcia Clark did a very good job and was unfairly maligned because, I mean, she was essentially in a situation, too, in which it was impossible impossible to win. I mean, all the hands were on the scale for O.J. Simpson in that trial. Just because of how crappy everything had unfolded with the police and the investigation after. It's like, that's a tough one. And particularly you have a jury who's like essentially asleep the whole time and giving the Black Power salute to O.J. Simpson. It's like,
only at the end.
Yeah, but he's just like, oh, by the way,
just
so you know, I didn't want to get kicked off the jury because I want to get you out. I'm going to give it to you right now. I'm going to give you that clenched fist. I was like, okay. But yeah, I mean, that is, and you know, it's like the thing, it's like pointing out a song by a band that you hate that is actually pretty good. It's like the Jeffrey Toobin book is actually really good. And if you have a nothing to read and that one's around, do pick it up because it's a pretty good story.
We should have him on the podcast. I think that's not the first time I've suggested his body. Because he's not at CNN anymore, right?
Oh, he is.
He is.
Is he?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little time out to get a washcloth. And, yeah.
By the way, also, I will defend him on that one. Sympathy.
Moynihan, you don't rub one out on the Zoom call.
No, but you do if you think the camera's off. Like, this is so boring.
No, I don't.
Why not?
No.
This is Matt, if there are no benefits from working from home, why don't you just go to the office? Great thing about working from home is you're just like, look, the guy, look,
you're
the thing you have
it
to
at
do.
The office.
Yeah. Do you ever, like, it's crazy and stupid because for one reason. Do you ever, like, hang up the phone and then, like, 10 minutes later you're talking about something, you, like, check to make sure that you've hung up the phone? Do you ever do that? Like, look like, I got to make sure I hung up. Like, they're not listening.
I don't live that type of life.
What do you mean?
If I'm talking to you on the phone and I hang up and I'm in the car with somebody and I'm like, that fucking moron. And, like, if I'm making sure that I'm I've hung it up. I mean, I think people out there, listeners, know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But if I'm taking my dong out, that I'm really triple checking.
Yeah.
I'm literally putting like a duvet over the computer. But somehow he was like, dude, I'm just too horny to even double check. It's impressive. I honestly don't care about that. Like people were like, oh my God. I'm like, yeah, no, it's fucking weird. But I mean, what are you going to do? By the way, Matt Lauer, did you see this news story?
He's coming back again, right?
Well, there was a story in the New York Post because he went to Don Lemon's wedding. With his girlfriend, and it was like there was some, you know, it's you don't trust these stories because they're like fifth hand. It's like a friend of his spoke to Page Six and said that he thinks that he should make a triumphant comeback. And I want to point two things out. I talked about this at a dinner last night with lots of people who, one of whom knew him actually, had worked at NBC, and it was just a bunch of journalists and people like that. And I did the test. What is the test? The test is, because Matt Lauer, someone brought that story up, and I said, what is the thing that you know about the story?
Yeah. Yep,
everybody says it. The button.
The button.
It's not true.
It's never happened.
And if you think that OJ should have gotten off because Mark Furman, you got to let a guy off if the button thing isn't true. It's already falling apart. So I think he deserves another.
Is Ronan Farrow the author of the button, or who?
I don't know if he's after the button, but he's the author of most of the material that took him down. And I do not believe him to be a reliable reporter on
certain
issues.
I was thinking about this today, apropos of, I'm not sure exactly what, but like one of the signposts of that 2024 is not 2018 or 19 or 20. Maybe I was thinking in terms of, well, yeah, it's a Christine Blasey Ford book.
That's right.
It's just
right,
like absolutely tanking. And people have like don't care and moved on. They've already used her, and then like they don't care anymore.
Exactly.
But there was a moment there where Ronan Farrow was like the it boy of all of journalism, and golly, he just is not anymore. Like that's not part of
the
conversation.
Who wrote the piece about him? I mean, well, the thing to point out is that, you know, credit to Dan Abrams for publishing Lauer's response to that, and credit actually to Matt Lauer for not just going away and hiding forever and actually writing in a piece and saying this stuff isn't true and here's why. And I found it to be a very compelling piece. I've recommended it a number of times because even if you don't believe it, it's like none of that stuff was in the bloodstream of the media when they were talking about it, because no one wanted to talk to him. Nobody wanted that side of the story. That was a point at which, I mean, the only people you question rapes about are Israeli women. And if otherwise you just you take the story and you're like, okay, you know, this is probably true. And I don't know the truth of this, of course, and I'm not going to make any judgment on it, but I'm just saying that I think that the response from him complicated things quite a bit, and that didn't really get into the stories that were being written at the time. Because when Knives Are Out were for people, I mean, a guy makes, you know, $60 million for being a morning show host, and people get very excited about watching them fall. There is something to that people are gleeful when rich and famous people are unseated. Because, you know, it's always like, well, who cares? They have a lot of money. It's like, well, no. I mean, these are the people that were big supporters of the mask mandates, so they could live a life again, so they go outside again. You know, because, you know, it was like you could swaddle yourself in 9 masks and actually go and, you know, go to the store and not have people bother you or people like point and stare at you. And I think it was really interesting to see him out in these photographs that he's actually coming out again and trying to kind of reclaim his life. How many years later? 6 years? It's a long time.
5 or 6, yeah.
5 or 6. There's a lot of time in the wilderness. But, you know, yeah, he made enough money that, you know, he can survive. But a lot of people that happened to couldn't survive and did go and work in, you know, like at CVS after being, you know, journalists or actors or things like that. I mean, you remember the famous thing is Armie Hammer. When we talked about that with Jamie Kirchick on the show, he was like, people were like laughing because he was like doing a real estate training course in the Cayman Islands. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And it was like, aha, handsome guy who comes from a rich family who is an actor. Like, good to see him, like, looking like a fool. It's just, I never get that gleeful, and I think that that's something that we all share in one way. Maybe you guys have different thoughts about this, but when it comes to people going to prison, it's just like, you got to do some really bad stuff for me to not care at all. But I'm always like, oof, yeah. If it's not a violent crime in particular, I'm like, geez, I don't know. I always feel bad. I always have these horrible thoughts of, like, what that is like for people, so...
Yeah, speaking of people thinking about going to prison, I think Donald Trump's trial for the Stormy Daniels hush money case is supposed to start next week in New York. So on the 15th, I guess he was trying to get the case moved to another judge, and he tried all sorts of different legal maneuvers to try and delay the case. But it seems as though this case is going to proceed. I did do a completely scientific survey of various legal experts' opinions on the matter, and it does seem as though most people seem to suspect that he will, in fact, be convicted, probably get probation, and not go to jail. But it is entirely possible that he gets locked up. And for folks who don't remember, this is a rather strange case in which Donald Trump is actually being prosecuted for a misdemeanor that the statute of limitations had run out on. And due to some kind of legal jujitsu, very novel legal jujitsu on the part of the DA in New York City, Donald Trump is now being charged for what, like 500 felonies, like one per letter in his name on every single check that he signed. And I'm only being so ridiculous about that. I think it's like 34 felonies. So it's pretty nuts. And I think the max he could do is something like 10 years, but I don't think that that is a likely outcome in this particular case. The more interesting story, and maybe just as interesting, is that Donald Trump is also angry at Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is trying to get the Speaker of the House,
quick name,
thrown out, Mike Johnson.
Right? There you go.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah, well, that's because they don't last more than like 2 weeks.
Yeah, I know.
Because between Gates Johnson. And Green, they just kind of get
through. And also his name is Mike Johnson, which is like, you know, if it was Hakeem Jeffries, who might be the next, you'd be like, oh yeah, sure. I know Hakeem Jeffries.
Character from an 80s teen sex comedy.
Yeah. So, I mean, in one instance, I mean, things looking not so great for Donald Trump because he's got this criminal case and he may in fact lose it. In another instance, it's interesting to see the kind of feuding amongst the MAGA cohorts. There's a lot of indications that Donald Trump is very pissed off with Marjorie Taylor Greene for trying to pull this stunt during an election year. Most Republicans seem to be pretty frustrated with her. In fact, I think I saw that Matt Gaetz is even on the other side of this and not particularly excited about the threat to oust Mike Johnson.
Really? I didn't see that Gaetz was annoyed about this. Is that right?
I think so.
I think the evocative phrase by some of the presumably Gaetz side MAGA people telling Marjorie Taylor Greene to step down is that it's past the trading deadline.
Uh-huh. There you go.
So trading deadline for those you non-sports ball people every year and every just major sports, there's a deadline after which you cannot make trades anymore. So up to this point, you can. And then afterwards, like, okay, it's too close to the end of the season, so don't do it.
That's one way of looking at it. I mean, the other one is that, I mean, it's clear that Marjorie Taylor, I mean, this is clear to anybody who pays any attention to her and, you know, people that are like her. I mean, in that there's that cohort of them, like Lauren Boebert. And there was a great story, I think Camille sent it, of Lauren Boebert was apparently like wasted.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Was at Mar-a-Lago trying to take selfies and like Trump was like, that's enough.
It might have been a party in New York or something. But
the
yeah,
bartender apparently cut her off.
Yes.
And then she probably jerked him off, but we don't know that. I'm just speculating.
She's just kind.
Just nice. From her past behavior.
Very friendly.
Yeah. Probably a couple of pumps in her. And she then kept, and like she got like a selfie with Trump and she like didn't like the composition of it. And she kept on trying to go back. And according to reports, Trump was like, okay, that's no more. And like pushed her away, which is hilarious. But they're like, those are like the congressional wine mom cohort, the conservative wine moms. And like Marjorie Taylor Greene is a very, very dumb woman. Let's just be honest about it. She's not very bright. And it's incredible to see her, like in particular, she was talking about how Ukraine and she was like, well, Russia defends Christianity while Ukraine is trying to destroy Christianity, which is like, wait, what? What are you talking about? And this is a part of the Ukraine funding stuff. And when you try to come up with an answer for we should cut off funding, there are better excuses than Christians are being persecuted in Ukraine. But she is somebody who loves one thing. And it's like, why of the 435 people in Congress is she probably the only one in the past 4 years who's gotten her own segment on 60 Minutes? Why her? Because she's obsessed with she's obsessed with fame. She's obsessed with the cameras. She's obsessed with creating these suicidal situations for the Republicans who have the thinnest of majorities to like, let's get rid of another speaker. And she's the person that's on TV all the time talking about it. And she's one of those people that when being criticized and being savaged in the press, it you know, hits all of her erogenous zones. She loves it. She gets excited by it. Not that people are like, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm doing something wrong here. She enjoys the attention.
Top five, top five in fundraising among all congressional representatives.
Correct. And that, of course, follows the fact that she's been very skilled at being a person who's on TV all the time. I mean, she's just, I mean, this is a very easy thing to do because all you have to do is be crazier than the previous person. And guess what happens? Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski and all of the idiot hosts on MSNBC have to, they get to, you know, warn us about the end of democracy because of this one dope out of 435 from Georgia. You know, who's
I mean, I want to say that Mika and Joe don't have a point about the end of democracy, but they do have a point about it's a bad political culture. They wouldn't put it this way, but I will. That rewards her. It just is.
Like, but it's the media culture that rewards her too.
Both. But like that's a self-reinforcing little loop, right? Where like both need each other. There's an easy way for the Republican Party not to be embarrassed by Marjorie Taylor Greene.
No, I agree. I agree.
And by Donald Trump and by Lauren Boebert and by Chip Roy. Although once in a while, Chip corks off a good one. Any number of people, Matt Gaetz, who also can uncork a good one too on a good day. The system has rewarded this type of behavior, and there has been, think of the 10 people who opposed Trump in the impeachment proceedings. They're all gone, all of them, in the Republican Party. And, you know, some of those are decent people. Some of them are people you might hate or whatever, but like it's 10 out of 10 is pretty clear. You can come up with a 10 out of 10 Yahoos thing, then put Marjorie Taylor Greene at the top of it, and they ain't going nowhere. Yeah. And there's no reason for them to go anywhere. This is what, it's not necessarily the default definition of every single Republican in the country. Not at all. It isn't. It is not. And stop pretending that it is. And when we focus only on national politics, that's where we start to make the category error of that's what every Republican is like. No, it's not true.
Yeah.
But it is also true that on the national level and sometimes the local level too, people who are like this are not categorically bounced. Like there isn't a mechanism by which, and the Democrats have this as well in a different way, of people who just say things like, what? You can't, no,
yeah.
Just what? There used to be that mechanism in politics. There really isn't. The last mechanism like this in politics that I can remember was actually sort of Me Too Al Franken mechanism in politics. I mean, John Fetterman, God bless him, Michael Moynihan's like new sexy American girlfriend, John Fetterman. Every day people ask him a question like, hey, John Fetterman, like, what do you think about the Yankees this year? And he'll say, like, tell you what, Israel's awesome and you should fucking fire Bob Menendez. Kick him out of the Senate. He's a corrupt son of a bitch. And Bob Menendez, for those following at home, is a Democrat. And it's kind of awesome, right?
And like, is Gold Bar Bob is absolutely corrupt, for the record.
He's been openly one of the most corrupt,
for years.
Like awful, I mean, for like a quarter century, years. At least.
It's incredible. But
it's,
I will say
totally
this,
incredible.
I want to agree with you and just the sort of general substance of that, in not saying that it isn't a Republican party problem too. I mean, they reward this stuff. And they, of course, see that when somebody is good at getting on TV, and it's a chicken and the egg thing, it's like, is she, you know, raising money because she's skilled in any way other than, you know, getting people on MSNBC angry, and then people rush to her defense, because that's all, it's been the thing for the Republican Party for so long now. And it's, I would say probably, I mean, it's gotta be around 2015, 16, there's examples of it before, but it doesn't, you know, the crazier things that you say, I mean, Donald Trump can say things that are, and this was the first example of this for me, saying things that were absolutely not conservative. You couldn't be a conservative and believe the things that Donald Trump was saying. And then everyone rallied to him and then changed the idea of what it was to be a conservative, basically. And that's things, you know, like tariffs and things like the way he treats free markets, even when it comes to, you know, healthcare and a whole bunch of other stuff. But one exception.
Gold star families, like fucking John McCain.
Exactly.
Honestly.
I mean, that
I like
was
guys
when,
who don't get shot down. What the fuck?
But the one thing I will disagree with you on is that I would not actually put Chip Roy in that group. And for one reason is that you can disagree with him on a lot of things and you can say he grandstands or whatever, but he is a man absolutely of principle. And it's not, I mean, I don't think that Marjorie Taylor Greene has any principle beyond Marjorie Taylor Greene and, you know, her getting more TV time and getting more famous. But I think that Chip Roy is actually somebody who does have a very core set of beliefs. And again, whether or not you disagree with him, he's an eloquent spokesman for those beliefs too. And I've sat down with him and interviewed him and I was actually impressed by him. He's attacked the party like pretty viciously on the House floor for saying you guys are being clowns.
He's just got a level of crazy to him.
It's just because he's got that
unscientific.
ZZ Top goatee.
I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't get any credit from you, Moynihan, for doing something that is sufficiently crazy that even Donald Trump says, hey, I mean, this broad is a total nut. Hey, no, Mike,
hilarious.
Why don't you come down to Mar-a-Lago? Let's hold an election integrity event together. That's what the serious Republicans are doing this week. Yeah.
The thing is that nobody, there's no honor amongst thieves in this way of that, like, you know, talking about abortion this week after the Arizona stuff, Trump says, I'm opposed to a federal ban. I mean, he knows which way the winds are blowing. I mean, he's taken about 1,000 different positions on abortion from saying that I'm fine with it. I'm saying to I am the most pro-life person in the world, saying that women should be put in prison, in jail, in response to a question from Chris Matthews, that should there be a punishment, where he says yes to that, which I don't think it means much because you can get him to say anything in an interview situation. He doesn't think about these things, which, by the way, is not the president that you want. There's not a person that you want leading the free world. But that, I think, is probably the motivation for a lot of this stuff. But then Lindsey Graham disagrees with him, and he, like, mauls Lindsey Graham. And it's just like, he doesn't give a shit. Everyone's afraid of him, and, like, everyone's, you know, always trying to kind of position themselves, you know, which way is the wind blowing in MAGA world? And then you have, you know, Donald Trump, just like, Lindsey Graham has debased himself so many times from being the anti-Trump guy in 2015, 2016, the very close friend of John McCain, to a guy that was, you know, his lapdog, to a guy who's being beaten up by him on Twitter or Truth Social, wherever Donald Trump is doing this. And, you know, it'll be gone again tomorrow because none of these people believe anything. That's the problem. And that's why I kind of slightly defend Chip Roy, because there's a few people that I've talked to, I say, oh, well, I actually believe something, whether or not I think what they believe in this situation is right. I mean, I am impressed by, but it's kind of like giving somebody an award for that is a pretty low bar. It's like when I interviewed Lech Walesa one time and he was complaining about Gorbachev getting the Nobel Peace Prize for not killing people during the uprisings. And he's like, you don't give a prize for not doing the rape. I was like, yeah, fair enough. It's like, this is the prizes that we give to people in politics. It's like, oh, you weren't as shitty as I expected you to be. Not that you're good, that you weren't as shitty as I expected.
I'm sure a lot of Lithuanians thought that was really awesome.
Yeah, there was a little brief thing in Vilnius that he forgot about.
Lech Walesa. Interesting guy, by the way.
Yeah. He was wearing a shiny green suit, by the way. It was incredible. It was like the most Polish thing I've ever seen in my life.
That was a uniform that was required in 1993, like Visegrad countries. Yeah. The abortion stuff is really, I think, super interesting, which is, you know, the callous way of looking at something that's a fundamental right, a fundamental, like, issue, not a right, to people. But the Trump is clearly feeling pressure in the general election, because anytime that abortion has come anywhere near voters in the wake of the Dobbs decision, they're like, fuck no, you guys went too far. The dogs caught the car and that's fucked up. The Arizona decision is fascinating because it's actually, I think, probably not a bad decision on the merits of it, right? Which was, they were sorting out a law. A law was passed in Arizona while Roe versus Wade was still the law in the land. And that law said, the new one that was passed just before, that they wanted to, like, bring down the time of abortion legality to be 15 weeks. But it presumed that it was legal after 15 weeks. Okay. But then the Dobbs decision comes down.
Presumably it was illegal after 15 weeks, you mean?
Yeah, sorry. The Dobbs decision comes down and invalidates Roe and throws it back to the states. Well, the state of Arizona has a law on the books since before it was a state, like 50 years before it was a state. 1864, it was like a couple of shacks and some dude with a big handlebar mustache. They're
were
like
there a lot of abortions back then. I don't even know. Is that a thing?
I need to read some renegade histories of abortion in Arizona. But the question in front of the Supreme Court was, how do those two laws harmonize? Did the 2022 law, again passed before Roe had been overturned, did it even have anything? Did it do the job of saying, oh yeah, by the way, the 1864 law sucks and we're overturning it now? No, it didn't, actually. And so it was a statutory interpretation. And the justices themselves said, like, we're not deciding about abortion here. We're deciding on statutory language and whether this law as written and what that has to do with this law as written and whether they harmonized or did whatever. And everyone lost their minds, which I understand, because again, it's talking about a very important issue. But also, it speaks to something that's not unrelated to Marjorie Taylor Greene and Mike Johnson and kind of congressional dysfunction, in the sense that legislating has like become a secondary thing that legislators now do. This is especially true at the national level, but it's also can be true in the local level. What the Dobbs decision did, which in some ways is really great for people who think that things should be legislated on the local level, is it kicked it back to the states and said, hey, look, we shouldn't necessarily have this weirdly argued, and it was, and decided case in Roe versus Wade be the sort of ad hoc jury-rigged law of the land. You should either have a federal law that says clearly what's going on, or you kick it back to the states and they figure it out. When they kicked it back to the states to figure it out, a lot of the states had passed, especially red states, had passed laws that were really restrictive. Some of them have ancient things in their books that they hadn't paid attention to for a long time. Arizona legislators can go tomorrow, and like all the Republicans are freaking out about this in Arizona, mm-hmm. right? And saying, this is a terrible decision. We need to do something about it. So they are also worried about the electoral prospects, because again, Republicans have fared very badly post-Dobbs in every election that has anything to do with this. All they have to do is legislate this. Repeal the 1864 law. We're not talking about this. It's just really hard, even in states like Arizona, which is mostly Republican. There's some swing element to it. It'll be a swing state in the election. It'll be the most – Arizona and Michigan are going to be the two most interesting states, I think, by far in this election. But like – you've got to actually do your job when the Supreme Court or other people say, hey, look, you legislator, legislate. People freak out and they would rather just like caterwaul and make it a political issue, which it is, of course, rather than like do what politics is allegedly supposed to do, which is, I don't know, legislate, make laws. So they can fix it if they wanted to tomorrow. And it'll be interesting to watch them not, I think.
In Arizona, I have to look up these numbers, in both chambers of the legislature there in the House and the Senate on the state level, it's a very thin Republican majority, right? And the interesting thing, of course, is Republicans should take some blame for the fact that the governorship is in the hands of Katie Hobbs, because they ran the craziest person on earth, Carrie Lake, who is just mentally deranged. And it's like, yeah, okay, so we've seen this before with Sharon Angle and, you know, Christine O'Donnell. I mean, do we have a history of doing this and watching? They still won't learn those lessons. But the interesting thing about it is to watch Republicans respond to this, knowing that they have a very, very low hit ratio on abortion, post-Dobbs abortion-related elections, right? They're doing horribly in all of them. They know that that's a weak point. Trump obviously knows that's a weak point when he's making an actually a conservative argument where he's saying this is about states' rights. This is about sending it back to the states. I don't want a federal ban, et cetera, and making, you know, certain pro-life people pretty angry because that's what they desire.
And also, just to interject, sure, not saying what his preferences are,
correct,
in the states.
Correct.
That's the problem.
Exactly. Which, by the way, is dumb, because you can actually appeal to Republicans and not be a crazy person by just saying 15 weeks. I mean, 15 weeks is something that when you look at polling is something that people generally kind of jibe with. They understand that because especially, I mean, 15 weeks, by the way, is a bad way of phrasing it. If you're a Republican, you should say 4 months because it's almost 4 months, right? I mean, it's a couple of like a week shy of 4 months and that's a long time. That's a long time. You know, you think about a pregnancy at 5 months and that's something that I think they don't really think about when they say 15 weeks. But the thing that I find pretty interesting about this on the Democratic side is that they have so little in this election because they have an incumbent who seems to have died 7 years ago. He is, I mean, by the way, that him in front of the, with the Japanese prime minister was just horrible to watch.
Oh, I didn't watch. Did he barf on him?
Oh, God, no, he didn't. I mean, George H.W. Bush was like a king compared to, like, he's just... He didn't know where he was. He was just walking in the wrong direction. He was reading off note cards. He seemed totally confused. It was one of those confused moments. I mean, he has moments where he seems better than others, but this one was especially bad. But you see Democrats running these ads, which I've seen people praising, of you know, highlighting people in, you know, Texas who have to travel. And then the what is the ad? It says, like, you know, Donald Trump did this. That was the ad. Yeah, you know, it's an effective ad in some way, but they're hammering this thing so much that it seems like a weakness because it's the only thing that they have. That's the only, they're not, they can't go in the economy, particularly now that you have these inflation numbers that just have come out and that excitement in January that we had turned a corner on, that seems to have not been the case. You can hit the job numbers, but that doesn't really resonate with people who have jobs, but the prices are going up and it's in, you know, auto insurance and, you know, just daily stuff, particularly when you have interest rates now that the Fed is obviously not going to cut those rates again. I mean, there were some people I heard saying that maybe they'd raise them again. I think that's not going to happen, but that's kind of crazy. But all of that stuff is working against them. And it seems that they're like, okay, well, the one thing that we're really killing on is a, no pun intended, is abortion.
Abortion. Jeez.
Yeah. Jeez. Well, it's the OJ episode. So we have to, there's a theme. No. Adults, babies, we kill everybody.
No.
But yeah, I think that there's going to be diminishing returns on that because it's like, look, that's what their weak point. It's like, yeah, but if that's all you have, I don't know how far that's going to get you. I actually don't think that's going to get them that far.
I mean, I don't know why those returns would diminish if people feel like and have on a pretty regular basis reminders of that, because the states, the laboratories of democracy, are going to be cooking up all kinds of weirdly crazy shit with abortion. You can bet on it. And there's going to be ballot initiatives in, I don't know, close to a dozen states, I think. So it's going to be part of the political conversation.
For sure.
And you can just rightly say, if you're a Democrat, the Republicans are the ones who want to restrict this as much as possible and make Donald Trump wear it, regardless of what he says. You know, it's one of the last things to really get Democrats excited. And it's, I dare say, so far has proven effective.
I just don't think that there are that many people, particularly on an issue like that, that are single issue voters, that enough of them to really pull them. I mean, look, that said, and I could be totally wrong about this, but that said, the polling numbers for Biden have looked considerably better in the past couple of weeks than they have in the past couple of months. So I don't know if that's it. I mean, it doesn't seem that that is it on its own, but I mean, these are fluctuating. And I mean, so many people pointing out, you know, we've talked about Harry Enten and him being on CNN, said if, you know, the election were held today and these numbers were right, in all these swing states, he's talking about Nevada, Michigan, et cetera, then Donald Trump would be the president. That seems to be, you know, the opinions seem to be vacillating in all those places now, which is pretty interesting. I don't know if there, I haven't seen numbers on why that is. I've seen a lot of speculation, but I don't think it's abortion and abortion only. But the Arizona stuff does hurt.
I doubt it has anything to do with abortion.
Obviously. Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with it, but that's, if you're abortion, only on that
abortion
one issue,
is an issue in October. I think the issue correct. Right now, as has been predicted by Matt Welch in this podcast, is that people are like, looks like Trump's really going to be the nominee.
Yeah, that's yeah.
And, I think
that's
probably and like, oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's we want to do this again is kind of the thought that I think is going through a lot of people's heads. You know, people, those independents, those swing voters, et cetera, it's not about, oh, Trump said that. There's the volume of that has made people dizzy over the years, and you don't even... you know, you talk about these things like, oh, he said, you know, throw women into the gulag if they, nobody remembers that. I mean, it's just that you know, 20 years ago, that would have been a thing. I mean, remember that, you know, Gerald Ford in 1976 said, you know, there's no Russian control of Eastern Europe. And it was like the biggest thing that ever happened. Like one fucking comment about foreign policy. And everyone's like, that was, people wrote books about it. Trump says enough things that it's now, I think, just, do we want to go through this again?
Well, since Camille is wearing literally a red baseball cap right now.
That know says what, running cult member.
MAGA cult.
Welch, you are our resident poll watcher. I know last week when we talked, everyone was up in arms about the Wall Street Journal story with all of the various swing states that seemed to be trending in Trump's direction. And this week, most of the headlines were about Biden being up ahead in the polls, although I think some of those were like general election polls. Do you have a sense as to whether or not the things seem to be materially shifting? It looks like we haven't had a poll out of Arizona in a little while. And the next
you're looking at the polls too much. We have 7 fucking months. Okay. 7.
I was asking you. I will
months.
Make,
no,
I
I'm telling you
attention as, to the headlines.
As someone who pays attention to the polls a lot,
doesn't
we have
matter.
7 fucking months. There's going to be foreign policy crises we haven't begun to fathom that will happen and be over. We could have a war in Iran. Like totally. Like, Iran could attack Israel as we're talking right now, and it could lead to a broader conflagration, and holy shit, what could happen there? China could fulfill Andrew Sullivan's destiny and invade Taiwan. I'm kidding, Andrew. Love you to death. But weird shit, there's enough time between now and then. Like, there could be, you know, Joe Lieberman, who's 82 years old, fell down and died.
Oh, I thought you were going to say he's going to get involved.
He's going to finally run for no labels. All kinds of weird shit can happen. The way to think about the
as Shane Gillis said about Joe Biden, he's probably the only president in history you could punch assassinate.
Oh no!
See, falling down is a real possibility.
Falling down, my God! Like, again, my dad fell down and broke his hip. That's what old people do when they fall down. Yeah. And he's only a couple of years older than Joe Biden.
Yeah.
It's like this Operation Bubble Wrap. Like, look it up, people. That's actually what they call it. And by they, I mean the people who work with Joe Biden, trying to figure out seriously.
Wait, is that real? I didn't know that.
That's real. Oh my God.
Is that true? How did I miss that? Operation Bubble Wrap.
Yeah. There's a feature in the New York Times about 6 weeks ago talking about this.
I missed it.
Like, let's make sure. And it's all like, he'll take shorter steps. If he's speaking in public, there will always be Jill in the front row. Yeah. So when it's the gong hits and you're like the cane takes you off stage, it's going to be her because he'll listen to her. There's a whole like rigmarole set up about this.
Oh, I missed that story because I always imagined
it bubble wrap, dude.
Was like when he walks into the White House and there's no cameras around, that it's like when a plane's landing gear doesn't come down and they spray everything with foam. You know, that like he's just walking around, like if he falls, he just bounces on the phone and they just pick him up again.
Everything is like the bubble pit.
That's wild.
Come on, get the ball pit. Come on.
The race is a push, people. So treat it as a push and don't get excited one way or the other. I had presumed that after people realized that Trump was the actual nominee, that there would be some micro trend towards Biden. It's kind of happened. Who knows if it'll last? And then the story becomes what happens with enthusiasm for the third party candidates. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be the New York Times did a big semi-scare story about how, you know, Trump supporters are strategizing how to pump up third party candidates. They meant to say mostly RFK, but in fact, I think it's mostly they want to get Cornel West and Jill Stein on the ballot because they are definitely left of center. They're definitely tapping into anger over Israel Gaza.
Did you see the tweet that I sent you guys from Cornel West, vice presidential candidate? What's her name? I don't even know who this woman is.
I'm blanking.
But I thought it was a joke, but apparently it was real. That it said that it was from 2020 that no white person should ever pronounce the word of the country Niger. Or Niger, as we used to say. It's now Niger. But it was like, no white person should ever say that. And I was like, this is a joke, right? It was like, no, that was a real tweet. Which I was like, wait, what? So now...
No, I mean, it could be a joke, though.
No, no, it was not a joke. No, it was not a joke. Humor. It was just like, I think that the rule that she was trying to establish, and it would definitely, she would establish as the vice president of the United States, is that you can't say words that are even close to words, like if it's like one letter off. So we can't say something is bigger than something else, because that is just too close, right?
I mean, when you said it, I winced.
Just say larger. Good Lord.
That's amazing.
How do I live in this black body, Camille?
I want to see the vice presidential nominee debate between her and what's-her-face from RFK, the Google gal.
Yeah, RFK's baddie VP.
Everything she talks about is like the soil has been contaminated, and that's why they're poisoning the food supply. And she's just all over, and it's great. Let's have that out there.
And she was married to Sergey Brin, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So she made some.
But no, the to see like it's a plurality election. Like I presume that there's a ceiling on Donald Trump's support. He got 46 point something in 2016, I think 46.1, and got 46.8 or something like that. I can't imagine 47% of America voting for Donald Trump, knowing what they know. RFK is polling at 10 or 11 or 12. Cut that by, I don't know, 40%, but I imagine he'll get like 7 or 8 if he manages to get on various ballots. And it'll be really interesting. I mean, to the extent that we are trying to part of this, the reason of this podcast is sort of like a media decoder ring of how to deal with the media that you're going to see. There's an interesting effort afoot right now. Democrats are all going to say that RFK is Trump Jr. He's just like, he's got Trump people, like the woman who's helping him with ballot access in New York is obviously a Trumpy. Big stories about her. So they're going to amplify, as they say, the parts about RFK that are Trumpy, and you don't have to like stretch to do that. There are parts of RFK that are Trumpy, that are more Trumpy than Trump. The Trump people are going to say that he's more AOC than AOC. He loves the Green New Deal. And both are correct.
Yeah.
And it's kind of great. And so they will do that not only to like scare their own voters away, but actually part of the code of that is to try to entice the voters of the opponent away. It's very similar to how our friend Peter Meyer and other people who were not MAGA got snookered or got hurt by the Democratic Party. Like, let's throw money into races where the Democrats or people who are affiliated with them will like pump up the MAGA credentials of the opponent of the person that we're actually worried that is going to win because he's a Republican. And so both sides are going to be doing that. And it's a real like open question of what happens to voters in that context. My total like hunch, suspicion, and based on nothing except vibes, which are very important in this world, is that you will eventually scare most, Democratic leading voters in line with that talk about RFK. There's going to be lots of stuff about various people associated with him. Yeah. It's going to be Trumpy. It's all a scheme, and et cetera. And people are, it's not going to be hard to get Democrats, freaked out about a restoration of the Trump dictatorship. And that will be maybe a stronger pull than the pull. And this is, again, this is just guessing, than the pull, of like people who kind of like Trump and certainly hate Biden, but they're like, Trump is actually a sellout on vaccines. I know people like this who think that Trump went too far with like Fauci and stuff, enabling him and claiming credit for Operation Warp Speed. He wasn't actually talking about all the harms that the vaccine have done, vaccine injuries. That is that is on a high fever pitch about how everyone is lying to you all the time. Trump gets most of those voters, sure, But there's going to be some of those people who are disaffected with Trump, and they will have definitely a person to vote for.
One thing about RFK, and it's funny because I've been very down on RFK, and you know, we debated Coleman Hughes in this issue, who has become a little RFK curious at one point.
Still is. Compelling on Joe Rogan.
Did he? Yeah,
he did.
But the thing is that a couple of episodes ago, I said something similar, but I haven't changed my mind on him at all. But I do find there's something compelling about him now. The reason he can run now and be successful, he couldn't run and probably get, you know, beyond just the Kennedy name recognition in 2012 or something. But post-COVID, you have this really interesting cohort of people in American politics who are a bit MAGA and a bit AOC, and he's a good representative of those people. So it's pretty interesting that somebody's out there and actually, you know, making those arguments. And it does scramble the brain of so many people that say, the same people that I'm sure said a million times in college, you know, America sucks because it has a two-party system and the parties are indistinguishable from one another.
Yes.
And now you have somebody who actually takes us out of that in a way and takes a bit from both parties. And people are like, democracy's at stake now. Yes, I get it, because Donald Trump is the person who you think is a fascist. But I thought it was also really funny that I got an email, like a publicist email, about a review copy of a book, which is yet another book that references in its title the Sinclair Lewis book, It Can't Happen Here, the 1935 dystopian novel from the ridiculous Sinclair Lewis, who, by the way, loved authoritarianism. I just didn't like the Nazi one. He liked the Soviet one. But he's, you know, it's interesting that people forget about Sinclair Lewis. But that this was a book titled, which I thought was so funny and perfectly typified all the conversations, the stupid conversations we've had about this. And it is a collection of essays from historians and political people, many of whom I know, and not know personally, but know their stuff. And it's called Did It Happen Here? And perspectives on the fascism debate, whatever. And So I got an ebook copy of it and started looking at it. And it was like within two pages, I was like, wait a second, let me go back to the cover of this book. Did it happen here? My dear, let me tell you something. If it happened here, you wouldn't be asking that question. The fact that you have to ask the question means it didn't happen here. I mean, that's if fascism does not allow for the transfer of power, even if somebody didn't want that to happen, and then for you to publish books about it, when you say, I don't know, did it happen here? Well, no, clearly not, which is why you're capable of writing this book and having this conversation. But, you know, that is the thing that I think, beyond the kind of re-scrambling of these political categories, one of the things I love about this, and I'm excited for Donald Trump to go away and to never have to hear of or about him again, which is obviously not going to happen anytime soon, but it has really exposed a whole number of people that I can't stand, which is terrific. People that I thought were allies before turned out to be their nuts. People that I knew weren't allies turned out that they were nuttier than I had presumed them to be at the beginning. And this is from every side of, I mean, being involved in the political debate now and listening to people talk in these absolutely catastrophic terms, not only about Donald Trump, but on the Trumpian side, just about America, the invasion of America, you know, and I think that as someone who thinks that the immigration issue is actually now a very serious one, I didn't think that in the past, but it's been a really interesting couple of years, I would say probably since the beginning of this podcast to today, and watching the kind of where people have gone. And that leads me, there's a long way to lead up to our friend Kathy Young, wrote a piece for The Bulwark, I believe, about this, you know, IDW, which was a throwaway term that Barry Weiss wrote in a piece a long time ago, and I don't think is a useful term in any way.
Coined by Eric Weinstein.
Oh, was that him? Was that he was the one? Who
made, yeah, he coined it, and it kind of stuck because Barry ended up writing this piece about him.
Right,
but it was kind of tongue-in-cheek when he said it.
But the one thing I just want to say about that, and I think Kathy is right about most things, and you know, I've known her for a number of years. I really like her. I really like her writing. Didn't love this piece for a bunch of reasons, but the one thing I'll point out about it is that to be careful, particularly in this time period after the past 8 years, is to attribute, you know, things that people say now and where they land to them 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. You can't see where people are going. And is it audience capture? Is it just a general ideological derangement when you live online? What makes people go crazy? And she points out a number of people who have gone crazy. And I think that she's right about a lot of them, people like, you know, the James Lindsay, who I never had time for, even when people thought he was more normal than they think he is now, and the Weinstein brothers and things like this. It's just, you know, people take these paths for a variety of reasons. But I think that the kind of blurring of it when I saw in that piece was that we all should have known this. And I know that Kathy would disagree with that. I know she would say that that's not what I was intending. But reading that, I just wanted to point out that a lot of these people are like, there's I told you so's. And then there's the people I always knew were like the, you know, Dave Rubin and these people who I don't take seriously. But yeah, I was wondering what you guys thought about that piece, because I know one of you sent it to me. I think it was Matt that sent it to the chain.
It was me, partly because Kathy, who edited and had been friendly with for 2 decades, yeah. Used the phrase IDW 52 times in the piece. And I think one of the temptations of the modern age of political commentary is to go, and Kathy's usually resists this more than most, is to go to a kind of group condemnation quickly. And guilt by association. There's a Freddie DeBoer attempted that. He's a very joyless writer that I know many people who listen to this podcast enjoy, and that's fine. Go ahead and keep enjoying him. I never have. But he tried to include Kat Rosenfield as like part of the Joe Rogan like crew who are just like closet Republicans. And it's just like, it's that regardless of whether you agree with any of that, it's like that attempt at guilt by association of like, you are in this group. We know that group is bad. Ergo X. And IDW, which was an Eric Weinstein idea, like just sort of like branding idea, didn't really go that far. But Barry wrote this big New York Times cover thing with all these like ridiculous glamour shots of people, Michael Shermer emerging from like the trees somehow is in this. And so people talked about it and it became a thing for mostly people who were irritated by those who were included in that group to hold on to, like, yeah, the fucking IDW, look at them doing it again. When that was the last time probably that anyone used it non-ironically. Mm-hmm. And so when you're doing that, then you're trying to attribute a group collective intelligence on an already kind of bogus made up category. And that way is not where insight lies. I do not believe necessarily. I think that you could, there is a smart piece and a smart critical piece to write about people, maybe including us, maybe not, but people sort of in our universe of those who used to work in mainstream media and now don't, and are largely on Substack and do a lot of podcasts and do this and that and the other. Like, you know, there, no doubt there will be people, for instance, tonight at the Free Press moderated debate in Dallas, not Austin, about immigration, where Nick Gillespie and Cenk Uygur, whatever you pronounce his name, sorry, are debating against Ann Coulter and someone else. Sohrab, actually, Amari. Actually, I wouldn't mind being there to watch that about immigration, right? That sounds kind of interesting. But there will be piss takers who will go there, as they always are. There will be piss takers at the dissident dialogues that Moynihan, for some reason, is participating in. In early May in New York, right? It's going to have a whole bunch of people, including some who've been on our podcast before. And that's fine to be the piss takers of it, but to pretend that everyone there is the sort of the same, and there, but also to do it as like a corralling exercise of, I have found the like compromised people, the bad people or whatever. And I'm going to ascribe some common intelligence to all of them, mm-hmm. No, it's it, no. And I'm sure that,
that frustrated me a little bit in that stupid Radley Balco debate that we somehow got pulled into in every media appearance that he made. But I don't ascribe this to him or attribute this to him, but I saw there was a conversation that, that I felt that people were trying to put us in that sort of box of those people that Kathy was talking about. Kathy, of course, didn't, and I don't think she believes that at all and didn't mention us. But I feel that that sometimes people think because we were early adopters of this culture has gone crazy and these people are idiots. And you hear that in the early days of the podcast. But we, you know, we drifted from that as that became a little kind of stale as a conversation and people, it just kind of was boring to us. Not that it went away. But yeah, no, I agree with that, Matt, that this idea that there's a kind of collective of people. And I just think it's like, it's everybody. It's not left, right, center, whatever. This is a thing that happens. And again, if it's audience capture, if it is just a general derangement of becoming obsessed with ideology and obsessed with politics, it never, I mean, there is 100 years from 1900 to 2000 where you can see people of every different political stripe going down these paths prior to Substack, prior to the internet, prior to Twitter. And it is an instinct that people have. And yeah, I don't think that, I think that also there's, you know, oftentimes some of those people, and I think that the ones that I mentioned, I don't think any of them had any ideas that I ever appreciated. But there's oftentimes people that I think that are pretty good and then go. And I think one of the responses to this, and I don't like getting into these internecine battles because I just find them boring and I hope that we're above this. But I just thought that was an interesting piece to read because for a variety of reasons, because one of you guys sent it. But I the only thing I remembered about it, because I didn't know much about this and I didn't pay attention to this stuff. The only thing I remember is asking Camille constantly, why is everyone mad at Sam Harris again? And it's like, oh, there's all these people that were friends and now they're longer friends. And I'm like, oh, that's boring. And then I texted you guys the other day that Sam Harris did a podcast, which I don't tend to listen to his podcast, not because I don't like it. I just, you know, I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. And I was walking from the like Battery Park City to like Midtown. It's like an hour and a half walk. It was a nice day. I said, I'll put something on. And I listened to one of his recent podcasts and he did a kind of monologue at the beginning. And I said, oh, yeah, this is why people like him. He's really good. He's really interesting. And yeah, I don't, the policing of, it goes both ways. I mean, the policing of is he the, does he have the right views? Is he on our side in this epic struggle? And I think that's the problem that Camille has and I have too, in the kind of tone of like when Chris Rufo talks about this stuff of this kind of existential struggle and we all have to be in this and we have to win. And I just like, I don't give a shit. You know, moving the needle in politics as an individual, as a podcast, even as a small subset of some small subset of a small subset is nearly impossible. It's really, really hard. And you can have a little bit of effect here and there, but the people who believe themselves to, you know, it's like when I was at Vice and they were like, you know, we can't put this person, we can't platform this person because, you know, people might like, no, you're misunderstanding the number of people who listen to you and actually care about what you say. And that is obviously the problem that most journalists have is they actually think that they change the debate and they change people's minds frequently. They do not. And you don't. So anyway, but that's a little digression. Yeah.
I for a second though, there was a Evergreen College got mentioned in the piece. And for a half a second, I was pretty sure I would see your name get mentioned in there, Moynihan. Did you notice that?
No, yeah, I did notice that. And you know, it's funny because the person that I interviewed that day or the couple days after was someone who was very, very adamant about that they really wanted to see Bernie Sanders become president, you know, and I don't believe he was faking that. I mean, if you were to say that something changed because of exogenous factors like money and audience, that didn't exist then. And I kind of believe that he was kind of a Bernie sort of guy because he did teach at Evergreen, which is a very left-wing place. And you don't kind of sit comfortably at Evergreen if you're somebody who's like a Republican or a conservative or even libertarian. So that piece, which I tried very hard to talk to the people. I mean, I think people thought that that was a much more opinionated piece than it was. If you go back and look at it, it really isn't. It's just that the people that you talk to are so fucking crazy And they were representative. That was not chosen. Like, let's get the craziest people. Like, let's get the people. And those were the people. And they were so bonkers that it seemed like a love letter to Brett. And and it wasn't. I met him that day, and I've never seen him since. And I've never interacted with him since. He was on the podcast once. I wasn't there. But
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I wasn't around for that. So yeah, I mean, it's
good episode.
There was we had a great time. Yeah.
Yeah. And,
he was wrong about capitalism, and that was fun.
Oh, and so he was doing this kind of socialist thing then too. He was talking about capitalism being terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to remember.
Yeah. It's, yeah. But you know, that I don't care. And it's like, it's so funny that when I had this conversation last night, the Tucker came up, and you know, I reminded people of the Carla Faye Tucker piece that he wrote for George Magazine, and everyone was like, this is a table of journalists, by the way. There's about seven people there, and everyone was absolutely gobsmacked. They said, oh, that was his story? No, one person said, he wrote for George Magazine. I'm like, no, yeah, people change. And you can't say like everything that he's ever done is tainted now because of where they end up. It's like, oh, he was always that person. It's like, well, no, the work is the work. And a lot of things change people. And, you know, you can like, you know, the earlier person, you can like the later person. It doesn't matter. But it doesn't invalidate somebody's work if they've gone around the bend on certain issues. It doesn't invalidate their previous work, I mean.
There's a, since you brought up Kathy, we're already in the weeds in it, in that piece. There's the small bit that I had a kind of journalistic or comportmental flinch / objection to, which was, busting Barry Weiss's chops, and Barry has bustable chops. We all love
you
Barry.
You want to hit Barry?
Oh, I hit Barry. I'm just saying that she's a figure in the world. She's standing above Substack like a colossus. She and Nellie are proud.
Wait, you said she controls the media. So you want to hit her and she controls the media.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah. Next time I'm staying at their house again.
And I will say that it's definitely anti-Semitism. Just one more though.
You know, in Camille, when he's talking about she's standing, you know, atop Substack, it is the motivation of most anti-Semites is jealousy. And that is a jealous anti-Semite. He's jealous of her success and he's anti-Semitic.
I'm jealous because she got to root for the Steelers growing up and I got to root for the Rams. And Super Bowl,
Pittsburgh is actually, I think, one of America's most underrated cities.
It's awesome. And it's like on the short list of where we should do a show.
Yeah, I love that. It's so cool.
After Chicago and Gainesville, Florida and the other places that we're going. But what I want to say is that she, at some point, criticized Barry for doing an interview with Vivek Ramaswamy, which we also did.
Yeah.
And that little, and it's a small thing. It's an aside really in the piece, but said,
it was like proof of her guilt. Yeah. She's kind
intimated that she didn't, that she treated him too seriously as a person and as a candidate and didn't foreground, that he's like a more of a deranged conspiracy theorist. And I listened to that interview in real time, actually, or close to real time. On one hand, you were part of that. I think you were in one location where Donald Trump was like being a union guy, and then they went back to the debate.
It might have been correctly. Around the same time. I think it was in the summer because I remember a friend of mine saying didn't know who he was, and said, "Oh, I heard this really interesting interview with this guy." And she's like, "I think his name was Rasmussen," and I was like, "You mean Ramaswamy? Not Danish." At all. But also, I think the things that came out as he ran for president, it's just what I was talking about before. It's like a chronology thing. It's like, if you talk about you interviewed, you know, so-and-so, and it's like, well, but at that point, I mean, even when he came on to our show and we busted his chops on a bunch of stuff, particularly on Ukraine and stuff, the most of the stuff that I knew that I thought I really disagreed with him on was that kind of foreign policy stuff. But to me, that was just ordinary kind of realist Republican, old school Taftian Republican kind of politics, right?
Like Silicon Valley messianism.
Exactly. Yeah. That's true. And then I think later, you know, we criticized him a bunch. Like he said that crazy 9/11 shit after. He hadn't said that before. That was well after buried. And like, keep those chronologies is kind of important because I mean, he revealed himself in ways that I don't think what people were aware of before. Also, he was doing really well in, you know, breaking out. Like you don't, this, that instinct, Like, it's a platforming thing. It's an idea of platforming. Yep. And like, if you're talking in, you're in 2008 or something, and you have, you know, Alan Keyes or 2000 or 2004, the guy's a nutcase. But if Alan Keyes is like getting media attention and he wants to come on the podcast, like, fucking great. Let's have Alan Keyes on.
Alan Keyes was in third place in 2000, right? It was W, McCain, and Keyes.
And Keyes, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And you absolutely have him on your podcast or your interview show, and you talk to him about his views.
Wait, who's 999 guy?
He's dead. Herman Cain.
Herman Cain, yeah. Herman Cain was like, remember Herman Cain had a little
moment. They all look
too
alike to you? Is that what I'm hearing from you?
No, I'm just thinking of another crazy black Republican. And Herman Cain had a little moment too. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. He shot up in the polls.
Ben Carson had a little moment too.
You,
the Republican Party is very diverse with their presidential candidates over the past 20 years. I gotta say,
crazy people.
Yeah, lots of crazies.
Not only will I defend the let you interview people. Like, he was third or fourth in the Republican Party race. That's interviewable by definition. But also that. As someone who listened to that interview in the car, driving around LA, I forget why, it was good. Like, Barry's interview with Vivek, it was like really interesting. It was in the middle of the chaos after some debate, I think at the Reagan Library.
That's right. Yeah.
She asked him an interesting question about Reagan because he was like a super Reaganophile. But then, has come out with some positions in his sort of late breaking populism that are kind of anti Reagan, and she asked him to square it, which was a good question. And it's actually good. And I don't like to see, it's not that I don't like to see Barry Ding. That's why I opened up the thing saying that she's
said
striding
you
upon the
you
world.
You want to punch her in her Jew mouth is what you said. that's what I heard. That's
a
what
bit
you said.
Strong.
This which I think is gross
kiss her
and disgusting.
On her Jew mouth.
Well, by the way, that's also homophobic. I literally want, I want to separate myself as a friend of the Jewish people. I want to separate myself from the vile anti-Semitism that is dripping from every single one of Matt's pores.
It's unbelievable. It's not
unbelievable.
Yeah. Where were you? Yeah, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I think this is the last episode of the show. I can't do this with such a vile.
You absolutely can. You always.
Hey, Matt,
have.
Did the Holocaust happen, or is it just the numbers a little high? What is your read on that?
Don't ask him about October 7th again. He gave the wrong answer last time.
Yeah. Journalism is great. Keep doing
Matt,
interviews with people.
Aren't you headed to Chicago this weekend for the Dexter Reed, the Justice for Dexter Reed March thing?
Actually, I want you guys to, since you've both followed it, given your racism more than I have.
look at him trying to pass the buck here. Look at the anti-Semite trying to change the subject.
I'm going to speak at the Windy City Justice Summit.
Yeah.
Run by the Students for Liberty. I'm also meeting with, and we're recording this on a Thursday night, so hopefully you will hear this before, but I'm meeting with some Fifth Column loyalists at a really super great bar in Chicago on Friday. And we're going to talk about like preparing the way for a live show in August before the DNC. And I'm very excited about all of that. And speaking to some other students and doing some other things, very busy time. I don't know much about the details about this, except for this headline, which I find very striking and worth dwelling on for a second. This is Dexter Reed, who was shot by police at a traffic stop in which he pulled the gun on them first. This is the
He shot a cop. Yeah.
Again, that's
and I believe
why
he was wearing a ski mask. By the way.
Yeah. So this is the headline in a insignificant newspaper called the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Police fire 96 shots in 41 seconds. Killing black man during traffic stop.
Yeah.
That's the headline of that. And of course, the Moynihan, what is the feature photo of?
As always, somebody in a graduation gown. It's always the case.
Yeah.
If you think of a picture of Michael Brown, what is the picture you think of? Michael Brown with his, gown and his cap and gown. Yeah. It's always.
And by the way,
the
writer of the story, Jennifer Hassan, is her name. And I mean no disrespect on her when I read you her bio, that a London-based breaking news reporter for the foreign desk at the Washington Post before joining the Post in 2016. She honed her breaking news skills as the UK social media editor at Mail Online.
The Daily Mail, yeah.
So she wrote for the Daily Mail, and she lives in London, and she wrote that headline about a shooting in Chicago. Do you want to see some other quick headlines from April that Jennifer has written? Hamas says it is studying ceasefire proposal after negotiators leave Cairo. Hamas says hostage talks are on hold. Netanyahu repeats intent to invade Rafah. Israel withdraws most troops from south at 6-month mark of Gaza war. This is all April. Man who received pig kidney transplant leaves hospital feels great. Afrobeats star Davido to sue over April Fool's article about drug arrest. Who is Alvin Bragg, the DA prosecuting Trump's NY hush money trial?
That was just her talking out loud. Wait, who is Alvin Bragg? I live in London.
So
I'm pretty sure it's DeVito.
I know,
the record, but it's fine.
Did you
know that actually?
No, but like I know how the Spanish language is supposed to be presented. But like,
I think he's Spanish. It's an Afrobeats and Africa. Afrobeat. But go ahead.
Well, yeah. I'm not going ahead. I'm just trying to help you. This is
he's really revealing himself this episode, isn't he?
How prestige journalism is
the
dealing
George with. Lincoln Rockwell Fellow at Reason Magazine.
Sometimes I feel like.
That's just Rockwell, but okay. Yeah,
there's no reason. Like, in a boat.
This woman is really something else because I do love the detail that of all the details that are in the headline, there are no details in the headline. I do love the fact that this guy was literally driving with a ski mask on. He was wearing a ski mask. Well, he pulled a gun and then shot at the police. And I'm trying to figure out, I have to watch the footage. I haven't watched the footage. I tend to not love watching people get gunned down, but you know, if they're shooting first, that it's a slightly different, but they're always focusing on the number of rounds that are discharged as, you know, as if that makes it excessive, right? Because someone's pointing a gun at you and then pulls the trigger. The thing that you're thinking about is, I want to go home to my family tonight. I have a job in Chicago as a cop. I get horrible pay and I want to survive this interaction. The man is wearing a ski mask. He pulls a gun on us, pops off a round, and they say 90 odd rounds. I'm just like, are they reloading? I have to look to see how many cops were there. But yeah, they return fire. That's what's going to happen. And anybody with half a functioning brain realizes that when you pull a gun on a cop, you're going to get shot. If you pull a gun on a cop and you fire that gun, you're going to immediately get killed. If you don't hit everybody first, they're going to open up on you, and they should. They have every right to, and I would do the exact same thing in the exact same situation, because your job is to stay alive. Your job is not to make sure that the Washington Post thinks there's too many rounds were fired. Don't fire a gun at a cop and you won't get killed, particularly when you're in a war zone, and that war zone is Chicago. And the cops are being fired upon quite frequently. It's not as if it was happening in East Egg. Even if it was in East Egg, the same result would happen. But you imagine that the cops are a little more ready for combat when you're in a place where there's so many shootings every week, every weekend, and so many people getting killed. This is not a mysterious case in any way. The fact that this is elevated to a national news story tells you something about what people want the story to be rather than what the story is.
Yes. No. Yes, I did watch some of the footage, and of course I mean we'll have to await the investigation, see what else is revealed. Could be some bizarre circumstances that suggest something else, but a police officer was shot. It does appear that after the initial barrage of gunfire, there was a pause in the action, then the car kind of lurches forward and they start firing again. So it's not as though there was just kind of this continuous discharge of firearms. It is certainly possible that there was also some reckless shooting and conduct that took place as well. But possibly, you know, you got a tactical unit who are in street clothes but are wearing vests that are all clearly labeled police. There's no doubt he knew these were police officers. He had a conversation with them. They asked him to open his door to keep his window down. He started to wind it up and eventually pulls a firearm and discharges it into one of the officers, causing some sort of injury. I saw some reporting that said that the officer might be not kind of necessarily to anything like mortally wounded, but could be sufficiently wounded he may not police again. I don't know.
I think he was shot in the arm. Isn't that what I read?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
That's what I saw as well.
Might not be right, but that's what I remember reading. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's I concur with all of that. I mean, certainly, if you don't want to get shot by law enforcement, good idea is probably not to shoot them first. In general, as a rule, and it seems to me that that is probably a more interesting dimension of this particular circumstance than the fact that the young man happened to be quote unquote capital B black. I think plenty of capital B black people get pulled over and don't pull and then discharge firearms into police officers during a traffic stop.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. So I was going through, I have a piece that I've written and filed and it's coming out soon. And in the process of doing that, this is about my old employer. I was going through a lot of these old emails that, were sent out by HR for some mysterious reason. And the piece is written kind of, you know, through a journey through HR over the years in a way. And one was about, you know, how horrible everything is and everything's been happening and, post George Floyd. And one of the people mentioned in two emails, which I didn't include this in the piece, didn't have time to. And I remembered this case and I said, oh Lord, it was a perfect example of people trying to make something into something that it wasn't, to increase the number of people that are getting gunned down unfairly by the police. And it was a guy a trans man in Florida named Tony McDade. Do you remember this?
No.
This was in May of 2020. Human Rights Campaign, I just Googled his name. HRC mourns Tony McDade, black trans man killed in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Black trans man, NBC News, fatally shot by Florida police. Rolling Stone, Tony McDade shooting black trans man killed by police, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. LGBTQ community calls for justice after Tony McDade, a black trans man, was shot and killed by the police. There's a lot of people of that time that we know their names. Why does nobody remember this name? The reason nobody remembers this name was because Tony McDade decided that he was going to commit suicide by cop and posted it online and had just shot his girlfriend or boyfriend and I think murdered somebody. And the police were called and he posted on Facebook that he, and I think he actually either discharged a weapon at them, pointed a weapon at them, and he said, I'm going to get killed by the cops and I want that to be the case. And it was in that moment, I think it was a little before George Floyd even, maybe it was around the same time, that he was lumped into this group, Tony McDade. And this is the same thing of this Dexter guy. It's the same instinct, is that enough of the information, it squares with what we want the narrative to be. So let's just go with it and hope nobody notices. Or, I mean, that the Tony McDade thing, look that up, people. It's kind of crazy. And I'm not even doing it justice to how clear it was that this person was a horrible criminal who had orchestrated the whole thing and was trying to get the cops to kill him, I believe after he had killed somebody himself. But that was left out of all of these. Human Rights Campaign mourns a murderer. So
it was August, 2020. This is what you do. This is how that works. I think Moynihan, you maybe chipped out there again.
Yeah, no, I did. It's been happening. It's very, very strange. My connection's strong, but I think it's a Riverside thing. But I just looked at this, by the way. I just quickly looked it up. Tony McDade stabbed and killed somebody.
Yeah. Oh,
okay. So,
and then when the police responded, he greeted them with the handgun pointed at them, and then he was killed. So, but he was trans and a trans black man who.
It is so weird. So weird to go back and look at like stuff from this period of time. Crazy. I'm looking at an ACLU post about this particular case, and Tony McDade was killed by Florida police this year. he should still be alive today. Across the country, black trans people are constantly targeted and harassed by police for simply being who they are. We can and must people do death. Better. Mm-hmm. And then there's a photo of someone holding a handmade sign, protect, which looks like it's on a folder, and scrawled on it. And she's holding this over her head, wearing a mask. Protecting black lives is an essential service. Hashtag black trans lives matter. Hashtag Tony McDade. What a bizarre time.
Yeah.
Very strange.
And by the way, this is a classic thing with the Mike Brown stuff, was very similar too, that it said some witnesses contradicted statements by the police department that McDade was armed with a gun. And of course, they released the police body camera footage that showed McDade was pointing a firearm at one of them when he was shot. And
doesn't he have a Second Amendment right, though, Moynihan? I mean, come on.
And this is also, the officer, this is fucking amazing. This was in a news story, too. In a Rolling Stone story, the officer also allegedly called McDade the N-word before shooting and killing him. Next sentence, this is in the Wikipedia. This was later proven false through the body camera footage. It's like amazing the lies that people launch out into the media sphere, hoping that these cases will gain traction and further prove their point that is cannot be proved by existing evidence. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy.
Huh. Huh. So, yeah. You know what? I just looked again. So it was actually May 27th that particular shooting happened. So
George Floyd.
Shit.
That was just after.
It was just after.
25th. Yeah.
It was 25th.
And this was the 27th. So yeah. You needed more. You needed the volume. More.
Exactly. And you had somebody who had just murdered somebody. Yeah. And that's so bizarre. And like,
that shouldn't be an instant death sentence, Moynihan.
Yeah, I know. They should have reasoned with him and said, put down the gun. And if they shot him, that's what you have to do, because it is really a hard life to be Tony McDade. So yeah, that case is totally forgotten about, but it kind of reminded me of that when I saw this thing in Chicago. So.
But there it does. I mean, the demonstrations in this most recent case, however, were not as large. And I have seen, in fact, I shared with you guys just a second ago, there was a post from someone at CNN, and the copy of it was, how did a traffic stop for not wearing a seatbelt end with 96 gunshots, an injured officer, and a dead 26-year-old?
Oh, I know. He shot at him.
Some say it was because Dexter Reed fired at officers first.
Some say.
As the initial investigation shows, some believe the stop never should have happened in the first place.
I love that those are two
Omar Jimenez.
Things.
Yeah. Omar Jimenez or CNN. That tweet has been deleted.
That's great. Yeah, that's great. Some say it was because he shot at the cops. Yeah.
That's what some people say.
Yeah. Those people. But some people also say that they love bacon and eggs when they get up in the morning. These are like totally unrelated. It's like it should have never happened. It's like, okay, well, if you want to debate whether tinted windows, wearing a ski mask and driving without a seatbelt on shouldn't get you stopped in a place like Chicago. Okay, but maybe mention the shooting first. That should be the thing that is actually the main part of that news story that we need to know as citizens. Right? Good God. Oh, my Lord. Say his name, Camille. I don't know which one. Tony McDade, say his name.
Nah, I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good too.
I'm straight.
Hippie Johnny.
If this was a paid episode, I would end with Little Modern Lovers right here, but it's not. So
okay,
but you should go and pay, because we really appreciate it, and
we do.
It helps us
second
out
Sunday,
and that's how you can find out where Matt Welch is going to be in Chicago. You have to go on the Substack.
Yeah, he didn't mention the name of the bar.
Nope.
Yeah.
No, but if you go on the Substack, you can find out.
Find out. Yeah.
It's like a gender reveal party.
He's a boy.
Yeah. Well, it's a gender reveal party. Is that Matt?
And a girl.
Matt is now. What would the female Matt name be? What would you be if you were trans, Matt? What would you change your name to?
All I have to say is go see a modern contemporary picture of the Indigo Girls. That's what I would
think. Wait, what? Seriously? I went to the doctor. I went to the mountain.
Yeah,
I drank from the river. I swam in the fountain, whatever the hell it is.
You know that a little bit too well.
Closer I am to fine. Yeah. Okay. So, God, I just took my microphone off its thing. That's in excitement gosh. Of the Indigo Girls.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We'll see you guys soon.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse, the fifth column.